Today is Tuesday, August 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Protesters in Minsk sang in the streets as they continued calling for President Alexander Lukashenko to step down. Plus, the latest on a bombing in the Philippines that killed at least 13.
The first explosion involving a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device, or IED, took place around noon near Paradise Food Plaza.
And a recap of the first day of the Republican National Convention. We'll have these stories and more next. A Belarusian court ordered an opposition leader jailed for 10 days on Tuesday as the government pursued a crackdown on the few figures still at large, with more demonstrations planned against President Alexander Lukashenko. Although most major opposition figures are in jail or in exile, Lukashenko has so far failed to put down protests against his 26 years in office, more than 2 weeks after an election his opponents say was rigged. Monday evening, protesters sang and danced in the streets of Minsk as they continued to call for Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko to step down. A bombing in a town on a restive southern Philippine island killed military and civilian personnel. And to learn more about the attack and its impact on the region, I spoke to reporter Stanley Gahete in Quezon City via Skype.
Two explosions occurred on Jolo Island in Sulu Province in the southern Philippines on Monday, killed at least 15 people as of today, including at least 8 members of the security forces, and injuring 75 others as of 10:12 in the morning Philippine time today. The first explosion involving a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device, or IED, took place around noon near Paradise Food Plaza in the walled city of Jolo's main town, killing at least 6 soldiers, wounding 6 others, and damaging 2 military vehicles. While troops were cordoning off the bomb site on the Serrano Street, a suicide bomber on a motorbike attempted to penetrate the area via another street and detonated explosives about an hour later, killing and injuring more soldiers, police, and civilians. According to Major General Corleto Vinluan, Chief of the Western Mindanao Command, ground troops continue to establish the circumstances and identify the perpetrators behind this inhuman attack. But based on the initial investigation of the Philippine Army and the Western Mindanao Command as of today, the 4 soldiers who were killed by policemen last June were on the trail of 2 female suicide bombers who triggered the explosions. The Filipino suicide bomber's Indonesian widow may be behind the latest Sulu attack. Jolo is one of the areas in the country's restive south where the Abu Sayyaf militant groups operate. The group is linked to many kidnappings and bombings in the region. Following the explosions, the military declared a red alert level in the entire southwestern Mindanao region, including the Sulu Islands, and it tightened the security checkpoints specifically in the provinces of Sulu, Zamboanga, Basilan, and Tawi-Tawi.
In 2017, Abu Sayyaf and a linked Islamic State group attacked Marawi, yes. And that lasted for some time. What kind of impact does that previous conflict have on the efforts moving forward in the wake of this bombing?
Actually, Steve, it's a surprise for everyone because as the anti-terror law was currently implemented now by the Philippine government, they are now linking if this is related to terrorism. That's why some of the military officers want the southern Philippines to be under the martial law. The Philippine government, of course, condemned this attack made by the terrorists because they are linking this to Abu Sayyaf and terrorists and killed many officers, police officers, and civilians. But they are trying to trace everything and track if it's related to previous bombings, including the 2017 in Marawi and also in 2019 in Sulu, which had happened during a year after now. So they are linking everything, if it's all interconnected.
Stanley Gahete reports from Quezon City in the Philippines. Republicans opened their four-day convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, Monday, and unanimously nominated U.S. President Donald Trump for a second term in office. Michael Sullivan reports, in a nation battered by COVID-19 and a recession, speakers argued there could be even darker days ahead if the Democratic Party nominee Joe Biden is elected.
In Charlotte, a scaled-down convention, partly live and partly pre-recorded, with Republican delegates from around the United States all backing Trump.
So the biggest little delegation of the state of Rhode Island proudly stands united to cast our 19 votes for President Donald J. Trump.
That evening, when the focus shifted from Charlotte to Washington, speaker after speaker defended Trump's handling of the pandemic and economy, as at the Democratic Convention, African Americans and Hispanics held prominent roles, including Nikki Haley, an Indian American and former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
The black small business owners who've watched their life's work go up in flames, they matter. The black kids who've been gunned down on the playground, their lives matter too.
Trump was shown at the White House meeting frontline workers who are fighting the pandemic and, citing his accomplishments, recalled his appointment of conservative federal judges, something he said his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, would not do.
The radical left will demand that he appoints super radical left, wild, crazy justices. Going into the Supreme Court, your American dream will be dead if that happens.
Democrats accused Trump of trying to slow the mail during the pandemic to favor his reelection by suppressing the vote of those likely to back Biden. Trump said Democrats are promoting a vote-by-mail scheme that could expose the election to fraud.
This is the greatest scam in the history of politics, I think, and I'm talking about beyond our nation. And they act like they're aggrieved.
It's a claim ridiculed by Democrats. Viewers were reminded of national protests by the Black Lives Matter movement, hearing from a St. Louis couple who brandished weapons when they felt threatened by protesters.
They're not satisfied with spreading the chaos and violence into our communities. They want to abolish the suburbs altogether.
Trump is trailing in most polls, but the election will depend on who gets out the vote in key swing states like Michigan.
I expect him to have more votes in Michigan than he did last time. And, you know, the energy policies and the manufacturing policies, the new trade agreement, all those things are of massive benefit to Michigan and to the upper Midwest as well.
Republicans have three more nights to try to shape the narrative before the election campaign gets underway in earnest. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
The world now has more than 23.6 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, according to statistics compiled by Johns Hopkins University here in the United States. Arab analysts say that the coronavirus pandemic is the third major crisis to hit the Middle East in a decade, following the 2011 Arab Spring uprisings and the start of the oil price declines in 2014. They say that innovation, both in the region's economies and in particular for Gulf Arabs who have relied heavily on oil exports and educational systems, is needed to confront new challenges as the world moves into more renewable energy sources and is increasingly technology-driven. Dale Gavlek reports.
Speaking with the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, former Jordanian Foreign Minister Marwan Muasher says Arab governments used authoritarianism to skillfully tackle the coronavirus pandemic. However, they should not apply the same to socioeconomic challenges facing their countries.
We need to move from rentier economies to productive economies, from patronage to productivity. It's easier said than done, but the oil era in the Arab world is over. Both oil importing countries and oil exporting countries need a different model of economic activity.
Analyst Dania Kolilat of the American University of Beirut's Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy argues that shale oil and renewables are pushing down the price and utility of oil. Writing in the Saudi Daily Arab News, she says oil majors like Saudi Arabia do not have the luxury of moving gradually from a rentier economy based on oil wealth to a productive modern economy. Saudi Arabia needs to achieve in one generation what other nations like China have achieved in three, and that's why innovation is key, she says. Saudi Arabia has relied heavily on oil revenues for some 87% of its budget. Plans to diversify its revenue streams, however, have been hampered by COVID-19. Still, the U.S.-Saudi Arabian Business Council reports that the kingdom's renewable energy projects could create up to 750,000 jobs while providing 7% of its electricity output by 2030 as one positive development. Meanwhile, the United Arab Emirates is moving ahead to develop trade, green economy, and food security, as well as finance, energy, and health sectors, incorporating technological innovations and digitization. UAE Vice President and ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, says it aims to be the fastest recovered economy in the world from the COVID-19 crisis. Moasha agrees that education that engenders critical thinking and innovation must be adopted quickly for the Arab world to move ahead.
We need to move from rote learning to preparing citizens. Our educational systems just do not prepare citizens to deal with the complexities of life. I'm not even talking about preparing them for the marketplace. COVID-19 is one such complexity. It's not going to be the only such complexity in the future.
Khalilat says Saudi Arabia must also generate and groom enough workers to take on new jobs as the kingdom transforms. Experts suggest artificial intelligence-based learning technologies can overcome current educational challenges and upgrade employee skills for the future. Dale Gathlack for VOA News, Amman.
VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. Facebook has blocked access inside Thailand to a group that's criticized the country's king. Reuters reporter Adam Reed has that story.
A Facebook group with over 1 million members has been blocked in Thailand by the social media giant over its criticism of the country's king. The Royal Marketplace group was created in April by Pavin Chachavalpongpun, a prominent critic of the monarchy, but users found their access was denied on Monday night after a legal request from the Ministry of Digital Economy and Society. Thai laws forbid defaming the king, with penalties of up to 15 years in prison. Pavin, who has exiled himself in Japan, told Reuters, quote, "Our group is part of a democratization process. It is a space for freedom of expression." Facebook has promised to launch a legal challenge to the government's demand to restrict the group. This all comes against a backdrop of near daily youth-led protests against the government, led by the former military junta chief, and unprecedented calls for reforms of the monarchy. By Tuesday, Pavin had already set up a new group with the same name and quickly amassed nearly 500,000 new subscribers.
Adam Reed reports for Reuters News. And still to come,
an independent report into Australia's Black Summer bushfires has recommended sweeping changes to land clearing practices and the creation of an international research centre to investigate extreme fire behaviour.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Myanmar goes to the polls in November, and Reuters' Libby Hogan brings us this story of one Rohingya politician who has citizenship but still won't be able to participate in the contest.
Aspiring politician Abdul Rashid was born in Myanmar. His father was a civil servant, but Rashid's name won't be on the ballot in November because officials accuse him of having foreign roots. And he's not alone. He's among a half dozen candidates who have been rejected, all of them Muslim Rohingya. Officials say Rashid's parents weren't citizens when he was born, despite documents that Rashid says proves his case. In Myanmar, they do not recognise the term Rohingya or the community as an indigenous ethnic group.
This is a pension letter from my father, and this is an updated ID from my mother. The Election Commission rejected me, even though I've submitted the form with all required documents. I don't know what the matter is, and I can't find any answer.
The citizenship cards of his parents, called national registration cards, were abruptly withdrawn in the 1990s and replaced with temporary white cards. And then in 2015, with the stroke of the pen, former President Thun Sein nullified the cards, stripping the Rohingya of their right to vote. Successive military governments that ruled Myanmar took away the Rohingyas' identity documents, leaving many with no proof of their origins. Rashid hoped an election win for Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi's party would in time see Rohingya rights recognised. But he has had his dreams crushed again.
Now this is a democratic government, and I had high hopes with Aung San Suu Kyi. The 2020 election is under her democratic government, and I'd hoped the policy would be amended and there wouldn't be any discrimination. We thought that we would be accepted as well, but that's not the case.
Of at least a dozen Rohingya candidates that have applied, six have already been rejected, all of them hoping for a chance under Suu Kyi's democratic government. Analysts say the polls on November 8th are an important test of the transition away from direct military rule. But more than 730,000 Rohingya were forced to flee from Myanmar in 2017 after a military crackdown that the UN said was carried out with genocidal intent. Rights groups say the disqualification of Rohingya candidates demonstrates the limits of reform in the country.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan. The wife of Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny arrived at a Berlin hospital Tuesday to visit her husband, who is being treated for suspected poisoning in Russia. Tests conducted on Navalny indicate that he was poisoned, but doctors said Monday that he was being treated with an antidote and his life was not in immediate danger. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called on Russia to investigate, but the Kremlin said on Tuesday it saw no need to do so until poisoning was conclusively determined to be the cause of Navalny's illness. Mali remains without a blueprint forward after 3 days of talks between military coup leaders and West African mediators yielded no decision on the makeup of a transitional government. The coup has raised the prospects of further political turmoil in Mali, which, like other countries in the region, is facing an expanding threat from Islamist militants. Former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan said the mediators were permitted to speak with President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, who has been held by the junta since he resigned last week. Keita said that he was not forced from office and does not want to return to the presidency, but wants a speedy return to a democratically elected government. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has arrived in Sudan, the top U.S. official to visit the African country since last year's ouster of its leader, Omar al-Bashir. Pompeo's visit on Tuesday includes discussing the normalization of ties between Sudan and Israel and also show U.S. support for the country's fragile transition to democracy. An independent report into Australia's Black Summer bushfires has recommended sweeping changes to land clearing practices and the creation of an international research center to investigate extreme fire behavior. The 2019-2020 disaster was unprecedented in its scale. Phil Mercer reports the Gospers Mountain Fire north of Sydney was the largest forest fire ever recorded in Australia, burning more than 500,000 hectares.
More aggressive hazard reduction or controlled burn-offs that can reduce the severity of future bushfires would make Australia safer, according to an independent panel. However, previous research has shown that as conditions get hotter and drier, it becomes less effective. But the report wants landowners in high-risk areas to increase prescribed burning. It also said that climate change was one of many factors that made last summer so extraordinary. The fires were fueled by record-breaking temperatures and a long drought across southern and eastern Australia. New South Wales State Premier Gladys Berejiklian says global warming is making the country more vulnerable.
The next fire season is already upon us. So the government has taken every action we can already in response to the recommendations that we received. We do have to also accept that in addition to the issues that have been canvassed this morning, our climate is changing. And those who wrote the report actually acknowledge that. Our climate is changing.
The New South Wales State Government has accepted each of the panel's 76 recommendations. The report has called for more scientific research into fighting fires, including the use of artificial intelligence and drones to help put them out quickly. It said the answer wasn't more fire trucks or firefighters. Critics of the inquiry have reportedly said it was lackluster and contained no significant recommendations. The Black Summer fires killed more than 30 people and destroyed thousands of homes. For the first time ever, catastrophic fire conditions had been forecast for Australia's biggest city, Sydney. Ominously, the panel warned that Australia should expect to see similar conditions or worse to happen again. For VOA News, Phil Mercer, Sydney.
Following the biggest blast to hit the Lebanese capital, a recycling initiative is transforming glass shattered across the city into jugs, jars, and other glassware. Reuters reporter Edward Baran has the details.
New life is being given to the blast-shattered glass that had littered Beirut's streets since the biggest ever explosion to hit the Lebanese capital. Under a recycling initiative, a group of volunteers collects the glass from the blast site, loads it onto trucks, and delivers it to glass factories in Tripoli, North Lebanon. Here, it's eventually turned into new jugs, jars, and other glassware. One of the organizers is Ziad Abi Chaka.
When we found out how big the blast was and the amount of damaged buildings, we started thinking immediately about what we can do with this amount of glass, especially considering that Lebanon is facing a garbage crisis already. So to add to that thousands of tons of glass, to add that to landfill sites wouldn't be acceptable.
Organizers say there's an economic benefit to the project too. Not only are they offering glass to factories for free, but they also receive funds to hire additional employees to help with the sorting process. The project's funded by individual donors and will continue as long as there's glass to collect or until the funding runs out.
Edward Baran reports for the Reuters News Agency, and you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past several years in particular, the Russian government has been working to undermine transatlantic unity and weaken democratic institutions in an effort to make its neighbors more dependent. That is why last summer, USAID launched its Countering Malign Kremlin Influence Development Framework, or CMKI. USAID is mitigating the Kremlin's attempts to undermine democracy and self-reliance of Europe and Eurasia by building the economic and democratic resilience of partner countries. Indeed, CMKI isn't about Russia, and it isn't about the Russian people at all, said USAID Assistant Administrator for Europe and Eurasia, Brock Bierman.
It's designed to help countries make their own decisions, to make them more self-reliant, to make them more independent, to allow them to decide.
CMKI is focused on four specific areas, said Assistant Administrator Bierman.
First and foremost, democracy and governance, which basically is an effort to help build democracies in all of our countries, allow people to decide the paths forward for their government, making sure that they elect the people who they want representing them in their government. Secondly, we're working on disinformation, independent media. It's important that people can rely on where they're getting their news, and so we're helping in that regard. Third, we're also helping in energy and making sure that we help our countries be more energy independent.
And finally, it's about the economy and allowing these countries to decide where they want to focus their trade and their partnerships. Unlike the Kremlin, said Assistant Administrator Bierman, we are very transparent. It is not just the Kremlin and its proxies that seek to create dependencies. Albeit employing different tactics, various malign actors are looking to create more influence in vulnerable countries. This includes the People's Republic of China and the opaque and corrupt business practices of its companies, said Assistant Administrator Bierman.
We're looking to make sure that, again, we help our countries be more self-reliant. They understand the agreements they're coming into or getting into with China, making sure that they understand that the technologies that they're using do create a security issue and one of privacy, making sure that whether it's the technology or the equipment, they understand exactly when they sign the bottom line, what the results are, whether or not they sign up to get that technology or whether or not they default on a loan.
Assistant Administrator Bierman advises that anyone interested in learning more about CKMI should go to https://www.usaid.gov/ and find out more about USAID's work.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.